Welcome back to Left Anchor. I'm Alexi the Greek.
And I'm Ryan Cooper. So we're welcoming back to the podcast a friend of the show, Matt Brunig, who has just started a new publication called NLRB Edge. And yeah, as you'll hear, it's all about the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board, legal entity that sort of, you know, runs labor law in this country, and all the crazy, you know, nooks and crannies of the law, and all the stuff that's coming out.
It's a great resource. It's a great discussion. We talk about a fascinating, bizarre case brought by the ACLU about their egregious firing of one of their own employees. That we get into, and I won't give any spoilers for that, but it is bizarre and interesting, and it's the kind of thing that this new service of his will explain and give the plebs access to, which is good.
Yeah, it's cheap for a trade publication, and yeah, ACLU members, if you're donating money to these people, you should listen on and maybe write them an angry email afterwards.
These anti-worker, it's anti-free speech and anti-worker ACLU. Never thought that would be the most appropriate way to describe that organization. But,
I won't give anything away, as you said, but you know, if this lawsuit was coming from like the Heritage Foundation, it would make perfect sense.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, so before we get to the interview, just got a note real quick that this podcast is now sponsored by the American Prospect magazine. And if you subscribe to the show at $10 a month, you'll get a free digital subscription as well as an option for a discounted print subscription, plus all of our bonus episodes. Subscribe at $5 a month, and you'll get our bonus episodes at patreon.com/leftanchor, I should say. And otherwise, just enjoy the show. Let's get into
our... Keep in mind, the American Prospect magazine has always been good, but since Ryan took over as managing editor, especially good. So you want to check it out.
Yeah. So let's get into our interview with Matt Brunig right now. Okay, Matt, welcome back to the program. We wanted to have you on to talk about, you know, your new publication, which is very interesting and quite different from, you know, your typical kind of newsletter based operation. Mm-hmm. So can you explain, first of all, you know, how it works in this database that you've set up to sort of go along with it?
Yeah, the new publication is NLRB Edge, which you can go to at nlrbedge.com. It's a legal tracking service for the most part. But also we'll have commentary that'll be interesting to non-lawyers. The idea behind this is that, you know, there are these services out there like Law 360, Westlaw, what's it called? Westlaw Today. I think Politico has one. Bloomberg has one. And a lot of lawyers subscribe to them to just kind of keep track of what's going on in the law. And there's ones for different subjects. And that includes labor law. The NLRB is the National Labor Relations Board. And that's what I'm covering here. And when I started seeing these like AI large language models, things come out like ChatGPT. There's another one called Claude Opus that I'm actually using more these days. I had sort of some ideas about, okay, so these things, they just kind of digest a bunch of documents and then you can ask it questions. You can do like that. That seems cool. And so I thought, well, I think I can download like pretty much every document on the NLRB website. And like, what if you trained it on that? Could it become like a labor lawyer? That turned out not to be terribly fruitful. just because the limits on the amount of stuff you're allowed to put in it is pretty low. But what I did find was fruitful is it can track labor law developments reasonably well, because those developments are just kind of put out in the form of documents, whether decisions or briefs or whatever. And so what I decided to do was I created a database that kind of took down every document I could get from the NLRB website. And then I wrote some programs that will just automatically update the database every day. And every new thing that comes into the database, I feed it through a large language model to get a summary of it. And then I'm able to quickly kind of take that and adjust it, edit it, review it, and throw that up on the site. So I'm trying to put a bunch of labor reporters out of business, basically.
Or the positive spin to use, you know, the technology that's threatening us all in favor of fighting for workers' rights, you know?
Yeah, it's undermining some workers, but to the benefit of many more.
It's
always a calculus.
It's funny. It's like you've described a trade publication, basically. And it's like the traditional way you would do this is you'd have it everything paywalled and you'd charge a subscription fee to like law firms of $10,000 a year. But so far you're going with this sort of like more distributed, you know, what is it? $5-$10 a month option, something like that.
Yeah, I did bump it to 8, although that is the Substack default. It is running on Substack, though it's not on the Substack website. Cause you know, you're right. Like the actual cost for this service is like hundreds of dollars a month or more than that, you know, depending on how you do it. And so I'm sort of angling a little bit there. But obviously I'm able to do it a lot more cheaply and I have a little bit more of a kind of mass audience of sorts that I can tap into. Right now I have 12,000 free subscribers on it. I won't tell you how many paid quite yet because it's a little embarrassing, but I haven't paywalled it yet. So the question is what percent of those will convert when I do paywall it? But yeah, it is a little bit different. And I don't know that the monetization structure might change. I keep thinking, you know, there are publications like the Payday Report where they just kind of go around and ask unions to give them like a few thousand dollars a year. And, you know, that adds up pretty quickly. So that might be a alternative path as well.
Before we get into the sort of specific, you know, cases and stuff like that, I wanted to ask, you know, you have this other publication, you know, or, you know, think tank, whatever you want to call it, institution, the People's Policy Project, you know, why start a new sort of separate thing? And is it related to something that I've noticed, you know, over the last, I was just thinking about the last presidential election when policy and particularly welfare state policy was like super hot. I was just writing post after post about Medicare for all and all these studies coming out. And like, what are we going to do about this? We're going to do child tax credit. We're going to do, you know, a paid leave and paid sick leave and, you know, start patching up this ratty ass system that we have. And that basically like nobody's talking about anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And so is that, you know, related to this sort of that, you know, Biden versus Trump, the entire discussion of welfare has completely slid off the policy agenda?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, we had a situation where for 4 years, everyone, you know, Bernie was kind of the front runner. And so a lot of people were excited about the Bernie issues, which were a lot of those issues. And there was just a need for that policy. And I think we put about 5 policies, depending on how you cut it, from PPP wound up on the Bernie platform. So, you know, it made a lot of sense. Now no one's talking about it. No one cares too much about it. The election's not going to be about it. The left wing is focused on Israel and Gaza at the moment. So there's not a whole lot I can do there. I do have 2 papers coming out at PPP. They're in the design stage right now. So, but those are just about applying welfare state, some of the welfare state stuff we've done to states, because, you know, there might be action in the states. But yeah, that stuff's kind of dried up and I don't know when it'll kick off again. Maybe after this election, there's going to be a question of 2028. No matter who wins this election, you're not presumably going to have Biden or Trump running again. So maybe Trump, if he loses, would run again. But that's sort of irrelevant. I guess the point is Biden will not run again. And so we'll have an open primary and presumably we'll have some left candidate and maybe there'll be, you know, room to kick that off. But yeah, the PPP is still churning a little bit, but it's a little bit on ice and I get bored and, you know, I start drifting towards labor law.
Well, yeah. And the NLRB has been one of the few, you know, positive parts of the Biden administration's, you know, leftward lean when he appointed who he appointed. And so that's a good area for people that aren't familiar with it to be aware of, because it's a place that we can continue to fight the good fight. So pretty important regardless of who we have in office, I'd think, right?
Yeah, there's been a lot of activity, a lot of legal developments there, and they're still pushing them. And, you know, there's a limited time here where they're going to push them. And there's also just a lot of stuff that, you know, I keep thinking there are people who are not labor lawyers but are interested in the ins and outs of unionization and stuff like that. And there's also a bunch of union reps out there, you know, shop stewards, things like that. And if you can just kind of pick up little tips and tricks that are easily digested and stuff, that might be of interest to people. And yeah, I mean, even after this election, it's going to be, especially if Trump wins, you're going to have a whole bunch of stuff happening at the NLRB that you're going to cover because they're going to want to try to revert everything as best they can. So, you know, lots of reasons to keep track. It's not a sleepy agency, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got some autonomy in it. And it's a place where you could actually move the ball forward, you know, in terms of like the broader left, like agenda in the way that doesn't require, you know, getting something through the Republican House or the, you know, Joe Manchin Senate. So I guess that, yeah, probably the biggest case that you've covered so far, the one that's gotten the most attention is this one from the ACLU, that is in the courts right now. So can you explain the background of this and what the ACLU is attempting to achieve with their lawsuit?
Yeah. So basically, I don't know exactly when it was, but a couple of years ago, it seems like they fired this employee who was a lawyer, Catherine O, not a labor lawyer. And she was fired, you know, according to them for essentially, she violated her obligation to maintain a workplace free of harassment, including by engaging in repeated hurtful and insightful conduct that impugns a reputation, a pattern of hostility towards people of color, particularly black men. And to
be clear, they is the ACLU. She worked at the ACLU.
Correct. The ACLU spoke those words at an arbitration that she participated in when she challenged her termination. And when you look at what they're saying she did that meets those, you know, that characterization, the two that stand out to me or that are the kind of the most bizarre is she said in a phone meeting that she was, quote, afraid to raise certain issues with her direct supervisor. And they said that's playing upon racist tropes because her black supervisor is a black man. She's afraid of a black man, that kind of thing. She didn't mention his race or whatever. Also, Miss O is an Asian woman, if that matters. And then there was another one where the national political director left the organization after Miss O and her colleagues, so that concerted activity, complained about his management. He left the organization, and she apparently joked in the meeting that despite the fact that he had left, she believed that, quote, the beatings will continue until morale improves, which is a funny line. I believe it's a Simpsons joke. And they said that this was racist because the former national political director is a black man, and it's violent imagery and whatever, right? So, like, he was doing beatings like a black criminal or something. Like, that's how they presented it. It's really bizarre. They fired her. She, you know, takes it to arbitration, but then also files an unfair labor practice charge at the NLRB saying, look, they fired me for my protected statements criticizing management. And the ACLU, honestly, I think they probably just kind of stepped in it here. You know, like those are probably pretextual reasons for firing her. Maybe they just found her to be difficult. Who knows? But unfortunately, the reason they gave for firing her was this, were these statements. But these statements are protected and you can't fire someone for that. And so now they're sitting at the NLRB with these unfair labor practice charges against them. They don't really have a defense, like an ordinary defense that you could raise, where you'd say, no, that we actually fired her for some other reason. What? No, this is the reason they gave for firing her. And so they advanced two theories as to why they should prevail in the case, that both of which said essentially that the NLRB just doesn't have a right to act in this case. The first theory, the one that I spent the most time on in the piece, was They're saying that because the ACLU has an arbitration policy, she has to go to the arbitration policy, that she can't go to the board to have her unfair labor practice charges heard. She has to do it for an arbitrator. And then for a while, they were also claiming that the general counsel of the NLRB was unconstitutionally appointed. And so for those reasons, the, the board can't act and cannot enforce her rights.
Yeah, let me emphasize the second part just a little bit to clarify that the effect of this would be to nullify the entire, you know, actions of the Biden NLRB general counsel, like the most pro labor sort of, you know, visionary we've had at the agency maybe ever, Jenna Brizzo, right? And replace her with the Trump guy. I forget his name.
Well, I don't know what the remedy would be, because their argument is that Peter Robb, which is the general counsel that Trump appointed and that preceded Abruzzo, that he had a 4-year term and that Biden fired him before the 4-year term was out and then appointed Abruzzo. But his 4-year term is now over, you know, like. Right. Do you put him back in?
So maybe it would just invalidate everything that was done, you know, under the Biden appointee, I guess.
Yeah, I guess he would invalidate it and then require her to be re-nominated or something. It's sort of unclear where, like, we know the theory doesn't explain how you clean up the mess, I suppose. Right. But there is a mess. Now, I will tell you that the ACLU did email me and say that they had withdrawn that theory. They're not pursuing that theory.
Right. They say why, or can you guess why they did that? Is it because the remedy is confusing? Or
no, I suspect you know the
action. It's not a winning argument.
I think they realized that it was not a good idea to do that, you know, for broader reasons relating to people not being happy with individuals challenging constitutionally NLRB. Now, the official reason they gave, which is kind of funny, is they said that it was a technical procedural issue. So I don't know. The arbitration part not a technical procedural issue? It seemed to be both procedural problems, right? Not dealing with the substance of the dispute between them and Ms. O. But that's
by the way, Matt, for the people that don't understand the implications of forcing workers to go to arbitration instead of the NLRB, why is that bad for workers? Can you explain that briefly? Like, if they had to do that, if they had to go to arbitration.
Yeah, arbitration is typically pretty biased towards employers, and arbitrators also are not necessarily going to be very good at applying the unfair, the National Labor Relations Act. The other thing is the board is, you know, you can access the board for free and you don't need an attorney, right? So you file an unfair labor practice charge saying, hey, I was illegally fired for protected activity. What happens is the board assigns you a board agent who is a lawyer, and then the board agent essentially becomes your lawyer. Like, not technically, it's a lawyer for the agency, but you don't need a lawyer. They will do all of it for you. For an arbitration, you know, unless you know all the processes or whatever, you're going to need someone to help you with that. So it's just a lot easier to access that. The other thing, and this is a much more technical point, is under this board, there was a decision called CMEX, which changed the processes used to get union recognition. And it changed a lot of things. But one of the things it changed is it made it a lot easier for the board to issue what's called a remedial bargaining order. So basically, if a union is organizing and they're moving towards an election, and during that process, the company engages in unfair labor practice, start firing people, start making unlawful statements and threats and whatever. Now they're going to be much more on the ball to say, okay, cut it out. Like, you just have to recognize the union. Like, we're just not going to do this. But if all they have to do is have an arbitration policy and you can't bring these unfair labor practice charges to the board, and instead you got to go through arbitration, then you're not going to be able to establish that the ULPs occurred, and then not going to be able to get the remedial bargaining order. Like, it would undermine all of that. So,
yeah, it's a, you know, I mean, like, to sum up, like, the arbitration is really much more biased towards the employer compared to the NLRB like procedure. And that's why employers want it. And this would be, you know, basically so that they could squirm out of a single, you know, having to reinstate a single person, like just blowing a massive hole in labor law for every company and every worker potentially. Right. And
yeah. And I think that's a key point is that it's not normally you think of the ACLU as they're coming in, they have some kind of impact case or they're filing an amicus brief or something. Like this is literally just a conflict they have with one of their workers. It's not like they set out and we're like, we have some position we're going to try to pursue in the court. Like that's normally what they do, right? They do impact litigation. This is not impact litigation. This is just, they have a real petty dispute with this one worker and they're just pulling out all the stops. To try
it's super weird, right? Like in the, you know, exhibit 3 or whatever, I saw, what is it? Like the COO and like, you know, the higher ups in the ACLU were like testifying and I'm like, what in the world over like a cliche aphorism about the BD, you know, about like bad management, using poor tactics to motivate people. Like what is going on? It's so weird for a free speech nonprofit, right?
It's very weird. And apparently this week, I think there were at least 3 days of a trial at the board. They're having their hearing in front of the ALJ and the, yeah. So that I would suspect that they were, you know, they were down there doing that. It's like, is that even aside? Okay. We're spending all this money on this management lawyer who's doing this goofy stuff. Like they didn't come up with this stuff. I don't think have like labor lawyers on staff. It was this management, a lawyer, Kenneth Margolis, who's, you know, he's a well-paid man. He's probably coming up with this and they're saying, sure, go ahead. But also in addition to spending all that on him, like what, they're just wasting time. Like doesn't the agency have, or doesn't the ACLU have stuff to do? I don't know. It's a very bizarre thing for an employer like that, that's so dependent on, you know, outside donations and making an impact to just be, you know, doing this kind of stuff.
It also seems like their arguments about what constitutes harassment, harm, and racism were like caricatures of the most reactionary crazies you could possibly think of, what they would say about wokeness. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you used the word afraid and that triggered me. This is like a literal quote.
Yeah,
like,
that was.
That a guy, like that an adult man said. And I just like can't
a very understand. Highly educated, successful adult man, you know.
Who all of these people, by the way, are the, like, have a power advantage. They're like the superiors of the like, it's just so, I mean, it's almost encapsulates the neoliberal, appropriation and abuse of actual leftist desires for anti-racism, anti-sexism, all those things, right? Like it's just like so cynical and obvious is the weird thing. It seems so transparently, bullshit, I guess. I don't know.
That some of these identitarian cliques or ticks that have developed could be used, in fact, for any egalitarian purposes, and not for racial equality per se. Yes, it is kind of something like that. Now, the one other I didn't put this in the piece, but I, you know, it's occasionally it got picked up by conservatives as well as leftists. Obviously, there was something in there for everybody. And, you know, for many years when conservatives would complain about this stuff, I would always say, and they would always roll their eyes, you know, there's unions and labor laws you could use if you're worried about these kinds of things and you could strengthen them and make it even better, you know, and, you know, they did. But like, this is a perfect example of this. Like, whatever you think about the craziness of employers and DEI, whatever. The NLRB has not been affected by it, you know, like the NLRB is still sitting there and saying, no, you are allowed to say you're afraid of your boss. That's definitely something you can do. And it doesn't really matter. You can say it's racist and do whatever, like we're still going to go after you. So,
yeah, I remember back in the 2020 in the heyday of the white fragility book, whatever that lady's name is, I forget.
Robin DiAngelo.
Yeah. Yeah. I read that book. I did a review of it, you know, and it has a bunch of those annoying, habits of mind, as you say. But one thing that she never mentions, which is, I think, undeniably a good thing, you know, across the board for like racial equality is unionization. This would be, you know, to be in a union, it means higher wages. It means wage compression. And it gives you ways that you can, if you are being discriminated against in the workplace, you know, there's remedies there. You could put stuff in the contract, this and that. She never talks about that. It's all about, you know, just like hectoring people, very, you know, individual. What you need to do is you need to reflect internally and do not organize with your, you know, fellow workers of color. I want to also emphasize like the context here a little bit. Like, you know, we currently have a super reactionary broader court system. And in fact, there is a case that's, I think, coming up before the Supreme Court from like Elon Musk and Trader Joe's. And they're attempting to declare the entire, and National Labor Relations Act, the whole thing, I think, right?
From the beginning.
Unconstitutional.
It's always been operating unconstitutional for, 90 years now.
And you could tell us about that, but it also, you know, to be giving this sort of softball pitch to a potential like right wing judge somehow, you know, to like in this legal context strikes me as like gravely irresponsible, you know, to give people even ideas like this that you could take before like Matthew Kaczmarek or something or the Supreme Court. But can you tell us about that case though? Like, what do you judge the likelihood there of it going bad?
It's pegged to a Fifth Circuit decision that reached a similar conclusion about the SEC. The basic argument is that, you know, we have separation of powers in the Constitution, executive, legislative, judicial, but these adjudicatory agencies collapse these things together, right? So the NLRB is both a lawmaker and a law enforcer. You know, they have their judges. So they're kind of both executive, legislative, and judicial all in one package. And that's not what the founders, you know, that's not what the framers intended. We're supposed to have three different bodies for that kind of thing. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, the thing with constitutional law is, you know, it's all BS, right?
So it's made up, yeah.
Yeah. So like so you basically need to start thinking politically here, right? Like, yeah. Do judges really want to do this as a matter of politics? It seems really, what would even happen, you know, if that occurred? Because you still have all these unions, you still have millions and millions of unionized workers. What they exist kind of within this structure, it would be sort of like if, I don't know, you just repealed all of like Delaware corporate law, you just passed a law that's just like you just drew a line between it and you're like, go. Like, what? How would the world continue? I don't even, it would be so chaotic, but you know.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose the some relevant history here is that the NLRA is itself like a compromise bill very much. It is not, you know, tremendously pro-labor and, you know, constrains the power of unions in many ways. And, you know, like the, if all of these, you know, legal contracts negotiated under the status quo regime, you know, one of those is, you can't do sympathy strikes. That's against the law. Well, if you get rid of the whole NLRA, could we have like, you know, boycotts like what's happening in Finland right now? Who's to say? But it's also who's to say whether or not the Supreme Court was cognizant of that.
Yeah, no, what would happen if you had to start it all over is it could go any number of ways. Not sure that it would necessarily be, more conservative friendly than it is today. The board, both as a, what it does and the rules that are in the NLRA, but also just the NLRB process is so tilted towards employers. The remedies there really aren't much in the way of remedies, no punitive damages. It takes so long. Like if you get fired and you want to get reinstated and your boss really wants to be a stick in the mud about it, that could take multiple years. I mean, this ACLU case has taken multiple years. So, you know, there's advantages to kind of using the NLRB as like a neutering institution that sort of nominally helps workers, but because of the processes really makes it difficult. And if you were to get rid of that, I don't even know. Are we bringing cases in federal district court now to enforce something like this? Does the statute just go away? If we're going to do that, how are we going to start staffing these? We're going to just massively increase the number of federal district courts and their staff and their judges. It's just, you know, it's hard to see. Like there's some efficiency reasons around creating these institutions like this. Like if everything that went before the SEC or the FTC or the NLRB or whatever was brought in federal district court, it would be, you couldn't do all the other stuff, you know, that they do.
There is a bit of an aside here, but there is, if I'm not mistaken, a case that is attempting to do just what you're saying with the whole regulatory state, right? The attempting to overturn the Chevron doctrine, which grants, you know, basically agency deference in cases of like unclear statutory language. And that would mean that basically anytime somebody's pissed off about some regulation, you know, rather than having to go through the sort of agency process, they just file a lawsuit. And you can imagine what would happen. And I mean, already you have, you know, hundreds of lawsuits against this or that thing, but that, to make it a function of the court system to have to process like probably tens of thousands of lawsuits every year based on arcane technical shit. Like, you know, what is the definition of a security or something like that?
What is an unfair trade practice or something like that? I mean, that one is sort of like, the entity that would get completely overwhelmed in theory there is now the legislature, right? Because if you're not having the administrative agencies can't create these code of regulations that kind of clean up the statute or modify it over time, then that means everything that essentially is put in the code of federal regulations would have to be put in the U.S. code and have to be passed by Congress. So like most of what Congress is going to be doing is essentially passing regulations like all the time. Yeah. And they already don't have time to do what they're doing. And obviously with the veto points and whatever, it wouldn't be possible. And I mean, I suppose that's essentially what conservatives have in mind, is they're saying, look, if you push it onto the Congress, they're just not going to be able to do a lot of rulemaking in general. And then the courts won't be able to handle these other cases and everything will get just kind of, you know, it'll be a libertarianism through just being just choking on the process.
It's of a piece with their hatred of the administrative state. So to attack administrative law, and basically, like, for people that don't know, like, all these agencies, they're doing, I mean, the contentious issue is, are they legislating? Well, it depends how you define it. It's philosophical, I guess. You know, what's executive? What's legislative? If Congress says, you know, we don't want dangerous work environments, and then you have an agency try to execute that, they have to figure out in certain circumstances what's dangerous and so forth. And like, if you don't allow executive agencies to do that kind of stuff, it's just going to be an absolute nightmare. But conservatives probably don't want many rules and don't want to have, right, lots of bureaucrats doing things. And they're just, you know, they want the wild, wild west anyway. So it kind of fits with their vision, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Let me ask about a couple of smaller things I was reading through in your NLRB Edge thing. Can you tell us this business about non-competes, non-compete agreements, that is, in employment contracts? The general counsel has been making some moves on that front, but it seems that they're stalled out. So what's the story and context there?
Yeah, so under the National Labor Relations Act, since I think 1940, there's been this doctrine essentially that, you know, rules that employers have, whether contained in contracts or handbooks or whatever, can violate the NLRA, just their mere existence of them, right? So a classic example would be a rule that says, don't discuss your pay with coworkers, right? Even if that's never enforced, just the mere existence of it is going to coerce workers away from engaging in protected activity, which includes obviously discussing your pay with coworkers as part of organizing. So that's like the general principle, but then there's a question, okay, well, what rules violate, you know, what rules qualify as that and what rules don't? And last year, the general counsel put out a memo saying that she believes that non-compete clauses, for the most part, violate the National Labor Relations Act because they would prevent workers from engaging in concerted activity. And the way this logic basically works is you say, here's a list of things that are protected that we think a reasonable worker, if they read this rule, would think they weren't allowed to do. And so she gives a list of five things, including concertedly threatening to resign, actually concertedly resigning, concertedly meaning two or more workers doing it together, concertedly seeking or accepting employment with a local competitor, soliciting coworkers to go work for a competitor as part of a broader course of protected activity, and then union salting in another workplace. These are all things that you are protected, you have a right to do, and that if you were to look at this clause, you would think, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. And because of that, the clause itself needs to go. That's the theory. And she, you know, there were efforts, serious efforts made to make this happen, to get a case done on this. One case called Barry Green Management, and more recently a case called Juvelee Aesthetics, and both of those cases settled. So we are coming up on a deadline here where it does not look like we're going to be able to get a case through the system that either confirms or disconfirms her theory here.
And this ties into a, you know, sort of a broader question that I have about, you know, all this legal arcana and like the deep structure of sort of the way that labor law is sort of produced. You know, like, you know, this stuff inside and out, and like, you know, you like to push on the points where you know, it's possible to push, like filing unfair labor practice charges against, you know, anybody that you, any tweet you see, there goes Matt.
Yeah. I'm the NLRB Twitter officer.
Yeah. But it strikes me as a stereotypically American hyper legalistic, hyper sort of court focused way of doing things, such that, you know, several years ago now, the general counsel had this idea that this is the way, you know, we should, you know, do things, that non-competes should be considered a violation of labor rights. And, you know, like it's completely plausible. You know, this is something that I have done myself. I went and applied for another job, got an offer, and used that to get, you know, a raise of like $5,000 at my current job. You know, so it's not like, of course, this is like, you know, helping workers' rights. But instead of just being able to go out and say like, ka-chunk, like this, we've got a new rule. That's what it is. You have to get a case through the system, just like sort of wait for one to come up. And, mm-hmm. and then, you know, in an entire presidential term, you can't possibly even get one of those. So like, what are your thoughts on the sort of, you know, this legal structure and, how, you know, how it might be done better possibly?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating, especially because it's done, you know, through this process, which is adjudication, that the board can't. The board does have rulemaking authority. It very rarely makes rules. But even when it does that, the courts all like to knock down their rules. they don't get a lot of deference, even when Chevron was in existence. They uniquely don't get deference, which is really bizarre. But yeah, so like, for example, they issued a joint employer rule. That was started, the process on that was started like basically day one when GC Abruzzo got in there, or the new NLRB. I guess the rules technically come from the NLRB, not the general counsel. But that got started almost immediately. They issued
a final. What does that mean, Matt, the joint employer
rule? Sorry. Yeah. It was going to be a rule that McDonald's is the classic example, right? Where it has all these franchises and then you have McDonald's corporate and they maintain that each franchise is its own business. So unlike a Starbucks situation where Starbucks has all the corporate stores, they're all owned by corporate. So that's why you could get this big Starbucks union together. With McDonald's, every store would be its own union, and they couldn't bargain together and create like a master agreement. So they issued a rule that was basically would make a company like McDonald's be like joint employer so that all the workers could kind of bargain together, right? And they put that thing started immediately when she got into office. They passed a final rule in October of last year, right? So we're only talking, took what, 2.5 years. And then earlier this week, a judge in the Eastern District of Texas vacated the rule. And now we'll have to go to the Fifth Circuit and maybe the Supreme Court. And like she'll be gone. Like this whole NLRB, this 4 years of governing, it'll be gone before you even have a chance to get this one rule done. But then, of course, like you said, the same thing happens with adjudication. With adjudication, the problem is just finding these cases, and also the parties have to be willing to go along with it, right? So the problem is that you can hit a party that an employer who just like, okay, I don't want to fight it. I'll go ahead and cut out our non-competes, right? Or you might have a charging party, the employee that's bringing the case, who is willing to settle for less than they could really get. And, you know, so you got to coax these parties into doing the right things to set up a perfect setup so that it can get to the board and be one of its like 250 decisions each year.
That's super promising. But I wonder, Matt, what do you think? Because there are a lot of arguments from whether it's Samuel Moyn or others who like understandably really dislike leftists or especially who want the courts to be sites of struggle for many of these reasons. It's like usually a reactionary place. So there's all these, you know, obstacles. It takes forever. But then, of course, like legislation's not easy for the left to get things through for various reasons. But it seems like a false dichotomy, right? Like these are all sites of struggle, whether it's executive action, the courts, legislation. What do you make of those arguments that try to say, you know, stop talking about the court as if it's a panacea, which seems kind of like a straw man to me? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Practically speaking, I guess you just kind of push on everything you can. I guess if you had limited resources, like you literally were running out of money and you had some kind of organization, you might then need to prioritize. But obviously, yeah, you gotta try to get rules through the NLRB. You got to try to get adjudications through the NLRB. You got to try to get the PRO Act passed or some other.
It's all connected too. That's the other thing, right? Like they all like the PRO Act would help tremendously with the NLRB, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that would be a legislative change would be incredible. I mean, that's what you need more than anything. But, you know, if you can't get that, then you have to mess with the other stuff. I see that actually in the labor law context, Clinton's, the NLRB chair under Clinton, William Gold, he wrote a Law Review article not too long ago that was the whole thing was like hectoring people who were trying to get the PRO Act passed or similar kinds of bills that would beef up the NLRA. And it was just, that's not going to happen. We need to focus on getting, I think it was the joint employer rule. We need to put our efforts there. And you read it and it's like, what is even this? What do you mean focus on it? I don't work at the agency. Like, how could I even what are you even talking about? And then it's funny, of course, that rule has now been vacated by a district judge. So that kind of stuff is a little bit, it's like low hanging fruit, I guess, to talk about what people should focus on and not focus on. But it seems kind of not as relevant as some people believe.
Yeah, you got to do what you can with the tools you have, and that'll vary between people. And yeah, so some people have encyclopedic knowledge of National Labor Relations Act business, and
each their own weapons, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't make sense for me to, you know, even in the broader debates, like, well, what about foreign policy? What about empire? And it's like, there's just a lot of people know a lot more about that than I do. So what do you want me to do about it?
Is there anybody trying to do like the way conservatives do these like fake cases? Like sometimes the details are actually fabricated. That case that went before the Supreme Court with the gay wedding, gay marriage wedding website lady who claimed that somebody had asked her to do it, even though she doesn't make wedding websites. And then it turned out that was a lie. Anyways, this pipeline, the way they do it, they go and they search out the plaintiffs and they find the most convincing and appealing sounding person and they fund their legal defense. Like anybody trying to push those cases through the labor law system, you know, like you get a friendly employer or something to put up a fake defense. You know, it's like, oh no, I won't do this. You know, like definitely don't force me to recognize the unions, whatever. Don't force me to do.
I've thought about that before. You know, the National Right to Work Foundation, seems to do things, like that, obviously in the other direction. The way that this, so this, the thing that's most similar to that is it seems like, so the general counsel will put out a memo at the beginning of their term that is usually titled Mandatory Submissions to Advice. And it'll pretty much tell you what they're trying to do. It'll be like a list of 25 things. It's always very like opaque, but if you know what you're reading, you can figure out what they're trying to do. And unions will clearly pick up on that and, you know, bring some cases. Like, so one was they wanted to make it easier for work rules to be considered illegal. and the union that represent the workers at Stericycle obviously picked up on that, filed a charge, and that was the case that they used as a vehicle. And so unions are good at this because unions can be the charging party, right? They can be the people who bring the case. And when the union brings it, at least that's one less person you have to deal with who might want to back out, right? Because if an individual brings it, they might want to settle, you know, and they have reasons to settle, like, oh, I just want to get this over with, or I want to get my back pay or whatever, right? Individuals are, you know, they have real lives, right? Whereas the union is like an institution is willing to just chill and hang out for a few years in order to get the law changed. So
one more sort of amusing story I found, that SpaceX was attempting to claim that it's an airliner. Can you explain what that was about?
Yeah, you know, this is part of that same case that with the constitutional challenges. It's all the same. It's all one big. You know, they've hired some high priced lawyers, I guess. But yeah, so in private sector employers are governed by the National Labor Relations Act, unless they are governed by the Railway Labor Act. And the Railway Labor Act includes railroads, obviously, but it also includes kind of any common carrier, and it's been extended to airlines. So this was a recent thing that, I mean, I don't even know if it's been covered. I guess I hadn't seen it, but it popped up in my little database that this is a new argument they're advancing, that not only is the NLRA unconstitutional, but separately it's an airliner. And therefore, it's not governed by the NLRA. It should be governed by the Railway Labor Act. And honestly, I mean, and I know I always associate this with Matt Iglesias because he seems to say it all the time. You know, the SpaceX play here really is just to run the clock on the Biden administration, right? So it doesn't matter whether this argument would succeed or not. It's just another way to kill a few more weeks, a month, whatever, you know, and then. If we can get Trump in there, then, you know, the NLRB might back off a little bit, right?
I'd like to talk a little about the PRO Act. I don't know. Can you refresh us on, like, what the sort of basics of that sucker would do? Like, what are the sort of big changes that it would make? And secondly, if you had your druthers, like, if you're designing a labor, you know, law system from scratch, would that be sort of like your aspirational goal, or do you think that, you know, there would be a better way to go about things?
It's a hard question. Obviously, like, the ideal labor, like, union arrangement is like you have in the Nordic countries, right? Sector bargaining, where all the workers in each sector more or less are in the same union, and then all the employers have their employer organization, and they come together every few years and bargain, and workers have a lot of rights. They can do political strikes. They can do solidarity strikes. They can, you know, that whole setup. Of course, one of the interesting things here is that, you know, labor rights are not always legislative, right? They're kind of driven by other things, right? And so... You know, I'm not sure that they even have like legislation that enables that per se. It's just that that's kind of how things have developed over time. And when you have the kind of power that workers have, you kind of can call your shots to some extent. As far as changing the NLRA goes, you know, there was the Employee Free Choice Act under Obama, and then there was the PRO Act here under Biden. Both of them have failed. They have some things in similar, you know, some things in common. You know, I don't know. It's all good, I guess. You know, we want a card check, right? We want to get rid of right to work. Card check meaning not having to do these union elections. Just if the majority of people sign a card, the employer has to recognize it. We want penalties, actual penalties for unfair labor practices, not just back pay. We want, you know, the ability to, like I said, end right to work. I think in the PRO Act, they also gave workers a right to a private right of action, which is interesting. So as a worker, you could decide to bring your case at the NLRB, or if you wanted to, you could bring it into a federal district court, which is funny. I guess you would do that if the NLRB was taking too long. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. I thought it was a great bill and would have been a good thing, you know, to pass. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I should sit down and get together a much better theory of, maybe I should just write one. I should just write a bill. Yeah.
The penalties part seems key to me. You know, it's you've before talked about how it's like unfair labor practice charge for, like, you know, saying or posting a tweet that says, if you try to unionize, I'm going to fire you. Oh, you can't do that. That's illegal. You have to put a notice up in the boardroom that you have the right to organize without me threatening to fire you. It's not like, you know, when Donald Trump defames E. Jean Carroll, calling her a liar, and he loses the case, and then he gets a $5 million penalty, and then he goes and does it again. The next penalty is like $86 million, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, because Trump is Trump, he won't shut the fuck up. But, like, yeah, that's what you would do if you're actually concerned about forcing people, like putting the fear of God into employers to say, like, no, really, really don't do that. We're not going to give you the lightest of slaps on the wrist.
Yeah, penalties are supposed to be set at the level at which you achieve the compliance you desire, right? And clearly that is not happening. Clearly the penalties are so low that employers do not care.
So how do you imagine, Matt, like the ACLU case, for example, in case it wasn't clear for listeners, like that seemed like a retaliatory firing of someone who's complaining about how they're being managed by their superiors. And you know, she's seeking to be, I don't know if she actually wants to be reinstated, but the remedy seems to be she'd be reinstated with back pay. But what would penalties maybe look like in addition to that if we had the PRO Act, do you think?
Yeah. So, reinstatement's a good point, by the way, because the penalties for that are offer of reinstatement. But I think less than a third, the board tracks this, less than a third of people
would
accept
want to.
They don't accept it. So it's whatever, right? You did get to get rid of this person. And if they're a union agitator, you know, good for you, right? Less, you know, and you get back pay. But here's the interesting thing about back pay. Under the current rules, the back pay is reduced by the amount of money you earned in the interim. So if you, if you get fired and then you were laid off for, like, you don't have a job for a month and then you go get a job, and you're chilling at that job for like a
year.
Just
get a month. That's it.
You just get a month, you know, or it might be a little bit less, you know, if you, you know, maybe you didn't get as equal pay, you know, so they'll find the difference there. It's almost nothing. So, I mean, you could just have straight up civil monetary penalties, $50,000 per firing or something like that. You could also triple the damages. They do this in wage and hour claims. You could also require attorney's fees, right? So that's kind of the structure for wage and hour claims. If you get wage theft against you, you can get a lawyer. The lawyer can sue them. The damages are they have to pay you the wages that they didn't pay you times three, and they have to pay your lawyer. So there's a lot of, you know, it's not mysterious things you can do to make the structure more, you know, punishing for employers.
Yeah. And, so we saw this in the Starbucks case, you know, where the company was just doing, just incredible amounts of outrageously illegal stuff, you know, the firing union organizers and, you know, making these sort of unsubtle threats and whatnot. And they, you know, ended up in court for a while. However, that seems to have, turned on its head. Am I correct? It seems like Starbucks is sort of getting ready to give up. Can you give us an update there?
Yeah. So from what I can tell, so there were like hundreds and hundreds of stores that were unionized. I don't know what the final count is at the moment. I think it's over 300. And there were hundreds and hundreds of unfair labor practice charges. The board, I looked this up recently. So the board can do a lot of things, but one of the kind of extraordinary things it can do is it can bring an injunction in a federal district court. So instead of going through the board process, it will just go straight to district court to halt the activity. 40% of the injunctions that they brought last year were against Starbucks, just one company. So what seems to have happened is Starbucks has kind of finally realized, like, they're just not going to be able to get out of this, right? There's hundreds and hundreds of its stores that have these unions. And how do are they going to bargain a contract at each one of these stores? How are they ever going to get rid of these unions? It's probably costing them a fortune to deal with this legally. especially with the injunctions. Like, eventually, I guess it seems like they've realized, according to the Starbucks Workers Union, that they just kind of need to give up, and that the best thing for them would be to create one master agreement that governs all unionized Starbucks stores, maybe some side agreements here and there for unique stores, but that's just going to be it sort of, as a matter of labor administration in the business, going to be easier than what they're doing now and cheaper.
Yeah, it's funny. It's in my, you know, the visits to the Nordic countries I've done, as we've talked about on the podcast now, like an incredibly tame relationship between workers and management. You know, it's just like the all the bosses will say, oh, we love unions. The unions are very important. You know, they stabilize the labor system and so on. And I think, you know, what this story shows is, like, basically you have to beat that into the heads of the bosses that, you know, it's like, after fighting this for years and years, suddenly they're like, well, I mean, if we just give them a contract, and then we'll have, like, less turnover, and that'll save us money, and we won't have to spend all of this, you know, millions and millions of dollars on attorney's fees. And, oh, hey, we could even put a little advertisement up. Look, Starbucks, union coffee, and maybe we'll get a little sales boost, and yeah, we can all go
all
home.
The unions will, you know, they'll tell their members to buy coffee from you, you know?
That's probably not, you know, not a trivial amount.
It's not. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. This is a bit of, but when I worked for the Machinist Union in Oregon, there was a dentist over there who essentially ensured that his dentist's office got unionized by the machinists. There were a bunch of aerospace workers out there. And, like, clearly his game was, this is going to be great because then all the machinists will come to my dental office. And, like, 100%, that was a genius marketing strategy. He seemed to be doing quite well with that. So, you know.
Good man.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, could be an example to the others.
There are definite benefits to being the unionized kind of entity in a big sector like that. Like, if you're Verizon in the telecom, or if you're UPS in the postal logistics, your union is able to help you in politics, right? The UPS, like, Teamsters is going to go to bat for UPS in politics, right? All anything that's going through the House, the Congress, that is of interest to UPS, the Teamsters are going to be there, right? Anything that's of interest to Verizon, CWA is going to be there. Now, they're going to be there in a certain way. You know, it can't be of interest to, you know, Verizon or UPS at the expense of workers. But if it's going to be helpful to the company, that's helpful to the people who work there, you have a whole other source of essentially lobbyists there that Democrats are very receptive to. You know, it's not totally ridiculous to wanna, you know, to think that there are some benefits to unionization for employers that are strategic about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you see this especially in really complicated manufacturing industries, like, you know, automaking. You know, it's like, Elon Musk is a, you know, megalomaniac against unionization, but his, like, cars are extremely poorly made. And one reason they're so poorly made is that the labor environment is so terrible. You know, the turnover is really high. There's tons of injuries, lots of racism in the workplace. And it's like, that's no way to manufacture a really, you know, high quality consumer product that's very, very difficult to manufacture. But yeah, I think, you know, it was right after the Howard Schultz guy, the guy who was going to be, you know, Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Labor.
Yeah, he ran for president.
Yeah. After he, like, quit, and it was, you know, over to some rando, you know, executive. It's like, these guys have this sort of megalomaniac vision that was like, how dare these workers? How dare they attempt to claim, like, a slightly bigger chunk of the corporate surplus? Like, I will burn this company to the ground before I, you know, recognize any unions. But
yeah, it was funny. It's funny because Howard Schultz, you know, it's, you know, not to get too sidetracked, but, like, he started it. He seemed very personally offended by it. There's an element of this where it's like, is kind of his business. It's almost like the difference between, like, a family owned business and a sort of just like corporate behemoth that where, like, the directors are just whatever, just like random stooges, you know, like if you have this investment in it and you're like, I made this and I can't believe people are doing this to me, you can resist in very rational ways. You go and you pull some MBA out of nowhere and he's just looking at it and being like, what are we doing? Why are we spending tens of millions of dollars a year fighting a totally futile campaign? Because we'll never get rid of these unions. We're still going to have to deal with them. They're constantly going to be requesting bargaining. Like, we just, you know, we're done. Like, it's just the rational planner versus the person who has like a personal connection to the business seems, you know, that can be very beneficial.
Just real quick, Matt, your point about how, you know, a good unionized business, they could become the lobbyists and the kind of promoters of that business, reminds me of a kind of policy debate back when we were doing those with Mike Konzol, when he was saying that a social wealth fund actually has problems because it would pit the workers' interests against the people that own shares in the company, because the profit, you know, something like that, like the profit of the company would come at the expense of the workers. So do you remember that debate? And can you remind us what your response to that was?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the way a social wealth fund work, and especially if you kind of get to its final form, like a Meidner plan in Sweden, is that all the companies are owned publicly. And so the profits, the surplus, the investment return, comes in to the public coffers or to a union coffer or whatever, right? Through some kind of social entity, and then is spread out in the society, maybe as a social dividend, like it is in Alaska, where everyone just gets an equal check. Or, you know, I don't know, you could spend it on other things if you want. And this does create a necessary situation where you're going to have to decide, okay, so how much of each company's revenue do we want to push out to the workers, and how much do we want to push out sort of to society as a whole? And yeah, I guess his view was, well, if we keep it so that all of the return of capital goes to a small elite, then we can constantly be pushing against them. But if we make it so that the returns of capital go out to everyone, now it's something that has to be negotiated. I found the argument, you can come back if you think I'm misrepresenting it. I found it just really, really silly, right? I mean, it's essentially an argument that says, we should never have a socialist system, because in a socialist system, now we have to actually hash out how much money goes sort of to capital and how much money goes to labor. Whereas we should just have a capitalist system where we just constantly fight over it.
Right. You know, that's the whole point. Socialists want to democratize the economy, which means democracy, which means figuring shit out that we don't have to under like the invisible hand or whatever doing it, you know?
Yeah. Like right now it's great if you're an activist, because you just constantly just get to be like higher wages. Why don't you just cut the profits? Why don't you cut the dividends and put it into wages?
It's more straightforward. Yeah.
Yeah. Or cut the price right to consumers, right? It's like, so you can, consumers and workers can just constantly complain and constantly activize against corporate profits. But when we all own the corporate profits, now we're actually gonna have to sit down and be like, what's fair here? How much?
It's really almost like saying, you know, slavery was awesome because the ask was real simple. It's like get rid of the chains. Like it's like really easy to like organize around that one simple ask, you know? It's like, well, I don't know if that's better though. Like, let's make it more complicated.
And I'm not trying to just be an activist. I think there's a difference there. Like, I like unions. I was a college activist. I've done the thing. It's fine. It is what it is. But like, I just want the society to run the way it needs to run. If you're having to fight all the time, then something's not going well.
And certainly you could say that, like, prudentially, it sure seems like it would be a lot easier, to have an outsized portion of the national income going to capital when the capital ownership is concentrated in a tiny minority of super wealthy, super influential people who are totally dependent on that capital ownership, versus whether it's like diffused over the entire government, and society at large, you know, like,
yeah, no individual has such a huge desire, because it's like, okay, so you increase capital share by 1%. What is that? Oh, my dividend goes up a few hundred dollars. You know, it's not as big a deal. You can make more ethical calculations because the benefits are so diffuse. The other thing, and I mean, this gets very technical, but at the point at which, for example, you're paying an annual dividend to everyone in the country based on capital share, if capital share goes up, that just makes the society more equal. Like, it doesn't, that is literally the most egalitarian form of income. right? Because wages vary based on profession and how many hours you work and whatever. This would just be equal to everyone. So it's like the big downside here is like less money goes to workers and more money goes to capital, by which I mean equally to everyone in society. It's like, that's not a downside.
It's for people that aren't following that, it's because like within industries, there can be vast differences in how much people are getting paid or even within the industry, right? And so this is, you know, another reason why UBI is a thing that's desirable because of the way that it's trying to distribute things.
There was a paper that came out of the Norwegian statistical agency that I used to troll some of the antitrust people. It was very funny. They were trying to calculate, you know, there's all this thing. Concentration is driving price markups and that's increasing capital share and blah, 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 right? And they were trying to see, is this true in Norway? And they found that it mostly wasn't true in Norway, but it was true in some industries that you did see something like that. But then they had this caveat where they said, because of the extensive level of state ownership of industry in Norway, this actually had an equalizing effect on the distribution of income.
That's good. That's good. Real paradox there, you know, paradox for your, you know, hyper-capitalist uncle. cool. Well, I suppose we're about out of time. Thanks for coming on the show, Matt. We will link to your new publication. Check it out. Definitely subscribe. You know, I don't think there's, at the risk of, you know, buttering you up a little bit, Matt, there's nobody in the game who knows, labor law inside and out and all the little nooks and crannies and, you know, ways you control people, that even some of the NLRB staff don't know. Matt knows.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a
future author of, Proact 2.0. So
creative. I'm a creative. A lot of my cases go to advice. That's always a good indicator that they're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. And when you're, when you come back on, when you finish drafting your, you know, sweeping overhaul of, labor law, and
yeah, I will.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in the next episode.